This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Living free.
Thanks to the Resident Frequency Radio crew for another great show, playing tracks and chatting with Collingwood artists. Welcome to Living Free, a one-hour show in which we highlight one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 on your AM radio, or 3CR Digital, or maybe even streaming on 3cr.org.au. My name's Michael, and I'm joined in the studio by my co-host Bill. Hey, Bill.
Hi there.
Hey. And, I might want to turn your microphone on. That would be a plan.
Hi there.
and today we've asked our guest, Lisa, to share their experience of recovery from alcoholism with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before we do that, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that this land was stolen and sovereignty was never ceded. Also, please note that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. So please consider your well-being and that of others while listening. Welcome, Lisa.
Welcome. Thank you.
It's great that you could join us here in the studio today. We like to start the show by asking our guests to tell us a little bit about their upbringing or their childhood. So what was it like growing up as Lisa?
Thanks. Wow, what a big question to start off with. So growing up as Lisa was actually quite confusing. I acknowledge that I am somebody in recovery today. However, I grew up in a household that was far from recovery. My mother had the illness of addiction, and unfortunately she didn't ever go into recovery and lost her life to this disease. But as a young person growing up in that household, it was pretty chaotic, very unmanageable and really, really tough. So I was born in Sydney. We came down to Melbourne when I was two. Dad was a high-powered pharmaceutical rep and Mum chose to be the dutiful wife at home. And I think for Mum and Dad, they were a couple that perhaps thought they were a good fit until they weren't. And, Mum started drinking very early on. In fact, there's, lots of evidence that shows that she actually had an addiction problem long before I even came along. Dad was, was totally not understanding. And Dad just... when things were tough at home, he sought comfort elsewhere, didn't really hide that, and he was very, very rarely home. So I grew up feeling very confused, had no idea, thought everything was my fault, was quite sad. I'm one of two. I have a sister who's 5.5 years older, who to this day I probably owe a little bit of my sanity to her. She really copped the brunt of what would happen, with Dad not home and Mum in full swing. Mum was really tough to be around and quite violent. She would often lock us out or, do some really, really tough stuff. And my sister, she buffered a lot of that for me. And I, to this day, whilst we live very different lives, I really do owe her quite a bit for that. And so, we had a pretty challenging childhood and, being 5.5 years older, she left home when I was about 11 or 12 and, Mum was an incredibly sad woman. So when she would hit the depths of her depression and her alcoholism, she would often think that there wasn't space for her in this world and would try and do something about that. And unfortunately, with my sister left home early, I would often find her And Dad really just kind of let me take on that role of, you know, being this saviour for Mum. And so I grew up, you know, a peacekeeper, trying to do everything right, people pleaser, and really scared of my own shadow in a lot of ways. Like, my sister was loud and out there. I would hide in cupboards, basically. So, I get into teenage years and I don't know how to do life. Like, I didn't have role models to say, you know, settle down at school, or this is how you create friendships, or this is how you do life. You know, I bumbled into friendships, and to this day I'm actually really blessed with strong friendships from all of my life. And I think early days I was just a bit of a chameleon to find friends. You know, I'd go, oh, that's what they do. That's what I'll do now. And so through my teenage years, I, you know, just would try and chameleon and fit in and try and belong, always feeling like I didn't belong, always feeling like I had to do what people said for them to like me. And so in these teenage years, I just didn't know how to be loved. You know, boys were around, always the wrong sort of boys. And I think, you know, with Mum still being really chaotic and dysfunctional, even in my teenage years, you know, my one goal in life was just like, let's get the hell out. But there was one year that I think shaped me, and in my HSC year. So yes, people are going to age me right now, and that's okay.
I did that in the cafe, I went,
last year of HSC was me. My mum got sober for 9 months, and and she'd had a really difficult attempt at her life, and at the same time, her liver decided it wanted to pack in for a while. We had a really great specialist. He even let me talk on the phone to him, which was amazing back then for those times. And we got her in and she got sober and came home. She came home with the promise of never drinking again because she thought it was going to kill her. Not because she loved us, but it was going to kill her. And that HSC year, I was on my L's, so I'm still aging myself. And I spent the whole of my HSC year taking her around to doctors, all of, you know, specialists, trying to help her stay sober, looking after her during the day, doing the minimum at school, and right up until I went in for my exams. And back in those days, you didn't have to submit anything until you went for your exams. So I crammed for like 2.5 weeks. And managed to pass my HSC by 7 marks. I was very proud of myself. Not that I knew that at the time. And then the week after I didn't finish my exam, she picked up a drink again. And the feeling of being so shattered. And I remember it so vividly. And I thought, I just need to get a job and get out of here, you know. And I did that. I got out and I was still looking for love. Still broken. And so, you know, I got back in touch with a guy that used to live next door to us. And he grew up very similar. You know, I was talking about our house being unmanageable. There was a lot of family violence. So when there was a knock at the door and we couldn't work out whether it was the police or the ambulance or whether or not it was for my house or the house next door... And I just so happened to hook up with the guy next door whose parents used to be just as bad as mine. I got engaged and fell pregnant and got married all at 19 and then had my first baby at 20 and thought, I thought, I've arrived. I can now.
Famous line from the book.
I know, I've arrived. And I've arrived because now I've got something to love me. Now I can create a family the way I want to create a family. And I can do it better.
Can I ask a question there?
Yeah.
Did you ever think about getting help for yourself?
Yeah, so interesting you say that, because I did forget to say, at 15 I landed in Allentine.
Allentine, yeah.
Yeah, for a couple of years. And the only way I knew to do that was because I was a regular with the school welfare coordinator at high school.
Right, okay.
You know, and she really saved my life, that this lady, because I would go and see her and go, I can't stand this anymore, I don't want to be around anymore, and she would support me, you know, and really that's probably the only experience I've had of an external person stepping into what today would have been very obviously a devastating family situation that would have had intervention, right? Yeah. You know, I used to go to primary school with no lunch, that mum wouldn't get out of bed and take me to school. So at the age of 4 and a half, I'm walking to school by myself, no lunch. I'm not sure that my school dress was always clean, you know, definitely odd socks. And not one teacher ever asked me if I was okay.
Yeah, I used to catch a school bus at the age of five. I used to catch a bus to school.
Yeah.
To primary school, and I got two alcoholic parents, and then no one thought it was strange. And when we moved house, my mother didn't even tell me there was a new bus I needed to catch, and I just caught the bus to the old house, and no one came looking for me.
Yeah.
That stuff, that chaos that happens in houses with alcoholics.
Absolutely. So, yes, I did do Allentine. I found that invaluable, because all of a sudden there were other kids that felt and shared stories just like mine.
Yeah.
And it was interesting, because that sense of belonging, you know, when I felt it there, I never felt it again until I came into AA many years later, many, many years later. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. And so it's interesting, like normally when we're talking to people and this is the AA show, like we're not even going to get to your drinking yet. There's quite a bit to go.
Absolutely.
There before the drinking starts. And so you're holding out as long as you can.
Mm.
So what does that look like? What is life? What happens in life if you haven't found a solution yet?
Yeah, your life is unmanageable. Mm. Yeah, like I don't remember a time when my life in my early years wasn't unmanageable. And unmanageable because of the emotional dysregulation I had. I didn't have anyone to show me how to self-soothe or how to look after myself. And so, back in those days, I did a lot of shutdown. I did a lot of dissociation. And I don't want to use like big words or anything, but I just looked like I was, I would just try and meld into the crowd and not look like I existed. And then unmanageability was that I couldn't do normal life admin. I was forever, behind in paying bills. You know, even when I was in my marriage, the two of us were so disorganized. All we did was up and move every 6 months because we thought that solved our problems. So I had one, my son Matthew was born, and I was just a baby, and I remember the midwife saying to me, oh, the baby's having a baby, And interestingly, becoming a mother, that was something that naturally came to me. I adored Matthew when he was born, and, John, my first husband, and I, like, we did all right, even though we're unmanageable, until our demons inside ourselves sort of caught up with us. Now, I wasn't drinking much, and he may have been drinking a little bit unnoticeably, really, to me at that point. But what I did notice was his inability to connect with me. He was an incredibly shut down man for his own reasons, and I'm certainly not judging him for that. But I remember saying to him, I can't do this. I need to feel something from you. Can we go and see somebody? And he said to me, going to counselling means you're weak and you're weak. And I remember thinking, well, I don't know if we can be together then. So here's me, and my daughter was born 5 months before our marriage broke down. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, I've just come full circle and now my marriage is broken down and I didn't do anything differently to mum and dad. And so I had these two little ones. 17 months apart, and I'm a single mum, and I'm 22 and a half, and I am like, oh my God, what am I going to do? And I was saying to you, Michael, before, there was a moment in that where I lived at home in the Mount Waverley home with my mum. Would you believe it? I went home to mum, even in all her addiction, with my kids, and met a lady who I started doing some training with around massage therapy, and also she offered some counselling, and I started my journey on trying to work out why I was the way I was. Mm. You know, I knew deep down inside I was more than just this chaos. Not long after that, I met who I call the man of my dreams. He was amazing. He was a little bit younger than me. Great guy. And we got together and, you know, it was that really intense love. I think a lot of people who have had addiction or in the fellowship would often say we do things full on, you know, it's all or nothing. Mm. Well, I fell for him all or nothing and it was absolutely everything. And we decided to stay together and build a relationship, and I fell pregnant again quickly, and beautiful Jackson was on his way, and he asked me to marry him, and so we got engaged. And when Jackson was 8 months old and we're 2 weeks away from our wedding, Mark went out on his bucks night and was tragically killed on that night by hit and run driver. And all of a sudden, within one night, my world fell apart. All of a sudden, I felt all those feelings of being abandoned, of thinking, how do I survive life again? Like I was just starting to feel normal. And then a couple of days after the funeral, I found out that I was having Taylor, my youngest child. Oh. Sorry, I'm quite emotional. Yeah, I'm not sure why. I found out I was pregnant with Taylor. And so there I was at, you know, 29, thinking I was about to live a very different life, and I was on my own again. Jackson was 8.5 months, 9 months, and the thought of, you know, doing this alone felt very unmanageable again. I all those old feelings of I'm not enough and the world should owe me a favour, obviously. And so then, you know, what I did was I had some really beautiful people in my life. You know, I was able to maintain friendships, and I had a beautiful lot of women around me that came and supported me. And I also had the beautiful support of Mark's family. My mum, of course, was nowhere really to be seen. She's still majorly drinking and very unmanageable. My dad, who had left mum by then but was unable to show up for me. And my sister, of course, you know, she was in and out of my life because her life was just as unmanageable, and she had 6 kids and I was about to have 4. So we just didn't know how to do it, right? So then, you know, fast forward 9 months and beautiful Taylor's born, and she's got a lot of complications, and so we spent the first year in the first month of her life in the children's. And I needed help from everyone, one to look after kids and to manage a home, and the deep depression started to hit in, and I was really feeling low, you know, and lonely. Just lonely. You know, I just didn't know how to do life. And still, you know, I talk about this unmanageability because all I did was I felt like I just went from one situation to another and never knew how to manage them or had no role models to help me.
So what happens next where is there a solution? Where do you discover alcohol?
Where do I discover alcohol? And look, I'm hoping that people don't judge me for this, but I do have two big marriages after that. and that's where alcohol came in, right? So there was a solution back then. My solution was find another husband. And, they're going to teach me to drink a little bit because that helps you to unwind and do life a bit better, right?
Yeah, you bet. Yeah.
So, you know, my first husband who also the husband after Mark had a lot of mental health. He drank too much. I drank too much with him. Our marriage ended in a lot of chaos, a lot of family violence. And I dragged 4 kids through that. And that was really challenging. I then separated for a while and then tried to do all of that all over again. Take 2, find another husband, rinse, repeat, another husband, another lot of drinking. And back then we'd sort of gained a little bit of materialism in that. And, you know, he and I had built a nice house and he had a good business. And I'd studied to become a nurse in all of that chaos. And we were doing all right. On the outside, right? Mm. On the outside, it looked fine. Still dragging kids through my unmanageability behind closed doors, and I was drinking too much.
Mm. Cool. We might actually take a break.
Yeah.
And we'll come back and we'll talk about what drinking looked like.
Yeah.
After this. You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Community Radio, 855 on AM radio or 3CR or on digital radio or maybe streaming on 3cr.org.au. If you would like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just search for 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us via phone or email. Today we're talking with Lisa about alcoholism and her recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. Before the break, you gave us some insight into your introduction to alcohol briefly, and maybe we'll move forward in time, just see where you're at when alcohol became troublesome. What happened next?
Sure. So for me, I think what I noticed was alcohol started to creep in during a time in that second marriage where I guess I covered it up by thinking I was just the most social queen ever. I loved a cheese platter and a glass of wine, and I started finding more excuses for that. I used to always be friendly with the mums at school or the mums at the footy club who drank like I wanted to drink. But at that stage, you know, I could keep it pretty well covered. There was a lot of time in those years where I would sort of ebb it up and ebb it down again according to if I felt like it was becoming bothersome for me. Listen to that word bothersome, like that's just, sorry. It makes me laugh because it was all troubling. I just, even in my head today, I notice how I put it undercover, you know.
How inconvenient.
Absolutely. Like, oh my God, it's bothersome now.
So you're in your early to mid-30s?
Yeah. I'm actually mid-30s. Mm. And I am, you know, feeling like I'm quite social. But what I would notice is I would have these nights where I really didn't know when to stop. And the night would get loose and I would wake up the next morning and go, oh God, I can't actually remember half of my night. Like, what was that? And my kids would be grumpy at me the next day. Like, don't you remember having arguments with us and so forth? And at that time, you know, towards my late 30s, you know, my second husband and I were going through a really difficult time. He had been lying to me about our financial situation, and we were heading in towards bankruptcy that I didn't know was happening. At the same time, my dad, who I was just starting to connect with, got diagnosed with bowel cancer. And, you know, I found myself in this position where I was deeply, deeply unhappy. I was working as a theatre nurse and I was doing a lot of on-call, and you know, there was not a lot of joy in my life. And so I would come home from a 10-hour shift in theatre and just drink and drink a lot. I was, you know, noticing, and I guess because of my nursing background, I knew really what Dad's diagnosis was. even though he's going through chemo. I knew the surgeon who had worked on him. I'd worked with him on different other cases, and I knew what he said to me when he wasn't saying it to me, so I knew we weren't heading. And then all of a sudden my closest girlfriend died in her sleep, and I didn't see that coming. And her and I used to drink together. She was one of those people that never questioned the way I drank. So I headed into this time where my marriage was falling apart. We became bankrupt. I lost my dad. I lost my girlfriend. And I decided to do a geographical to Queensland, as you do.
Why not?
Drag kids up. Two of them, the two eldest had left home, and the other two came with me. And I wanted to leave my husband during that time, but, you know, I was so unable to stand up for myself. I couldn't do that, but I made our lives miserable. Got up to Queensland, and then it was I was on a mission to prove I wasn't an alcoholic. I'd have a couple of big days, and then I would have three drink-free days. And I was a witch on those drink-free days. I would go to bed at 7 o'clock at night so that I wouldn't drink. And then I worked as a theatre nurse up there, and I would manage my life to within an inch of it. You know, I would work out what shifts I was doing as to what theatre lists I was on, to how much I could drink the night before, whether or not my hands were going to shake and the surgeon was going to see it. And if I wasn't working the next day, wow, that was just open slather. Until one day, when all of a sudden I had an argument with my daughter, who was then 16, and I always get emotional when I talk about this. We had a disagreement. Now, her and I didn't fight, like literally did not fight. And I called her, excuse my language, I turned around and said, oh, you little bitch, like this. And all of a sudden, like she just slammed her door, like that's not what we did. And I went into the bathroom and I looked in the mirror, and all of a sudden I said to myself, I'm my mother's daughter, and how did I get here? And it was the most, I guess, the most shuddering moment of my life. Like I promised myself that I wouldn't end up being like my mum. You know, and I think I said to you before, you know, mum, my time with mum was difficult, but I did love my mum. But there was no part of me that wanted to be my mum. She didn't leave me anything that I was proud of. And so for me to look in the mirror and see her, I just felt devastated. And at that point, I thought, I need to do something about this. A friend of mine who I used to drink really beautifully with in Melbourne had just recently gone into a rehab. And I was really upset with her for going into that rehab, because I told her there wasn't a problem. We didn't have a problem with drinking. You know, it was an illusion. She was just sad. And if she could fix her sadness, then she'd be okay. So when she went in, it confronted me and I got cross at her. And then when I had this moment in front of the mirror, I instantly knew I needed to do something about my own drinking.
So what's your first port of call?
My first port of call was, interestingly enough, not AA, funnily enough, even really? Though I'd done Alanteen. It's so interesting, isn't it? I'm always quite confused by that, because I always thought it would have been. I rang the rehab that my friend went in. I don't know, like, what do you do? Yeah. And then I rang them, and this is the funny thing. I rang them and said, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? And they laughed and said, well, you usually don't ring a rehab. And I just went.
Good answer.
Great answer, right. I just went, oh, yeah, okay, right. Now, this is the October, right? And I rang them and did a verbal assessment over the phone, but like it was a really little one. And the lady said, well, we think you probably, you need to come in for an assessment. I said, well, I'm in Queensland and you're in Melbourne. And they said, well, we'll get someone to call you. And they did. And I had this really great conversation with somebody. And they said, well, when can you come in? And I went, well, I'm not going to Melbourne till December for Christmas. And they said, oh, well, why are you ringing us now? And I just went, well, aren't I meant to do something between now and then? It was just, it just shows how naive I was about the whole thing, considering I lived with a mother. But of course, you know, she didn't go into rehab, so I didn't know about it. So then from the October through to the December, and I made a decision that in the December I would go down to Melbourne, do Christmas as usual with my extended family, and I would go into rehab after that. This is a really deliberate understanding of I'm not going to drink anymore. So I had between October and December to try and work out how to live in that time. Still not thinking about going to AA, which I feel still find amusing. But between that time, I tried to modify it even more. So I started, and this is the insane, I started going for 10K runs the morning after I drank to prove I wasn't. I would allow myself three drinks and then make myself stop, but then would find the most incredible excuses to go back and just finish off the bottle because you don't want to let it go stale, right? And so this went on for months. And what I noticed was my self-esteem, my self-worth, I was just getting more and more depressed. So it was kind of answering my question of this is a problem that's actually not going to be fixed until you stop. So then I came down in that Christmas. I went in for a formal assessment before Christmas Day and they said to me, yep, you definitely qualify, even though I was having drink-free days, even though I was, everything on the exterior looked amazing.
There's a bit of a vision, isn't there, what an alcoholic looks like?
Absolutely.
That, you know, that it's the person in the park with a brown paper bag, or it's the person who drinks every day, or it's the person who's drinking at 9 o'clock in the morning, or it's like there's lots of labels that are attached to what that's what alcoholism is.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't fit a nice shape.
Like no, and I didn't fit that at all. You know, I was still a theatre nurse with a career. I was a mother. I still felt like I had all the things. Mind you, my second daughter had stopped talking to me at that stage, not because of my drinking necessarily, but because of my emotional dysregulation and my unmanageability and my inability to own anything. Like emotionally, I could not own if I hurt somebody. It was too hard, not because I felt like I was better than anyone, it was more because I felt less than anybody. And so, you know, I get in there and I remember sitting down and bawling my eyes out to the admissions team going, please don't let me end up like my mum. And I just remember sobbing and going, I don't want to die like she did.
Mm.
And of course, you know, you've got the submissions looking across at this woman who's far from dying at that point of alcoholism. You know, I'd managed it to within an inch of its life that I almost was not drinking anymore because I was so frightened of it. And yet I still was. Like my drinking was still very unmanageable.
But they've seen all, you know, they that's their job. They just
exactly.
See them all come in and they just go, yep.
There she is.
There she is.
So what do? I do Christmas. I behave myself.
Ooh.
I do Boxing Day. And I thought, that's my last hurrah. My admission date's the 27th. Let's go, girl, you know.
Yeah.
And I go out for dinner and I order a bottle of wine and I don't finish it.
Ooh.
And I don't finish the glass. And I get up from the table and I go, I'm done. And I can't even begin to tell you that first wave of relief that came across me at that moment. Now, interestingly, I thought I had to rock up at the rehab the next day sober. Nobody told me the rules. So I rock up sober the next morning and go, here I am, looking amazing. And then all of a sudden I walk through the doors and my daughter turns around to me and she goes, Mum, don't go. You're actually not that bad. Look, you haven't been drinking much at all. Surely you should just come back home with me now. And I remember apologising to her and saying, I'm so sorry. but I know that if I don't do this now, I'm not going to be what you need for the rest of your life. And I don't know how I knew that then, but I knew I did know that. And I remember walking through those doors going, that is the first and the last time I walk through these doors and I leave her, because I don't want to do that again.
Cool. That's actually a very good place to finish up. We'll do the AA bit in a bit. That's
okay.
You're listening to Living Free on 3CR Digital Radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au. We just heard Aloha, Stephen Dano by Radio Birdman. Today we're talking with Lisa about alcoholism and her recovery through Alcoholics Anonymous. So you've made it to rehab and you've hit the bottom and you've reached rehab. So we're going to ask you what your introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous and what AA's done for you.
Absolutely. Well, what has it done for me? It's changed my life, basically. So I get into rehab, I fall apart, and they tell me that there's a suggested way to get well. And at this point, I don't want to drink again. I want to be a different person. And I had no fight left in me anymore. So I did what they suggested. I did my 28 days. I got as vulnerable as I could. I went to meetings. My first meeting of AA was, I think I was like 5 days in rehab and I just finished my detox, and I walked into this meeting and I got asked to share, and I actually don't remember a lot of what I'd shared on my first meeting. I know I cried a lot through it, but the one thing I remember is how I felt and that feeling of belonging again. Similar to when I went to Allentine, I felt it all over again and I thought, oh my God, I'm actually home. And I know a lot of people say that when they get to AA, but honestly, I felt it with every bone in my body. So that spurred me on. Throughout that admission, I did what was suggested. When I left the rehab, they suggested that I get a sponsor, find a home group, do a discharge plan that incorporated a meeting a day, and basically don't pick up a drink. Whatever I do, don't pick up a drink. So I left rehab, and the first meeting I went to was Glen Waverley on a Wednesday night. I walked in. I was feeling so nervous, so scared. And there was this fellowship of people who literally welcomed me in. It was in this beautiful place in the old venue back in Kerry Road. And it was amazing. That was welcomed in. I sat next to this beautiful woman who's no longer with us. Her name was Diane. And she sat me down next to her and she said, now when they ask how many days you are, you stand up and say, I'm such and such days. And I'm like, oh, okay. And she kind of coaxed me and she said, now at some stage you're going to have to get yourself a sponsor. And I knew that. And so in my mind I thought, how do I ask somebody to be a sponsor? It was so nerve-wracking. Anyway, the way I decided it was, I saw this really lovely woman who I saw across the room and I thought, I literally want what she has. I liked the way she looked. I liked the way she smiled at me. And I went over to her and I said, can I talk to you about, and she finished my sentence and said, sponsorship? And I said, yes. And she said, let's organise and go for a coffee. And it was like going on a first date, honestly. I remember going and meeting her for coffee and feeling so nervous I was shaking. And she absolutely did everything to make me feel comfortable. Yeah. And believe it or not, she's still my sponsor to this day. Now, that was 12 and a half years ago. I walked into Glen Waverley on that Wednesday night. Glen Waverley is still my home group. But what I did do is they told me to get into the middle of AA. And so there was this incredible group of women in this group and they just folded me in. And, earlier on when I talked about this low self-esteem and these terrible belief systems, these were the women that absolutely showed me that I was okay to be around. Mm. They helped me with my self-esteem because I watched them. They helped me understand how to run a program that was healthy, that allowed you to become well, and how to get honest. You know, I wasn't a naturally dishonest person in terms of I wouldn't want to lie to you. I wouldn't want to deceive you or be a bad person. But
I would.
But I did. Like if you rang me and I didn't answer, I would swear black and blue you never called me. You know, like I would lie about the most stupidest things because innately that was part of my disease. But these women showed me, a role model to me, how to get honest, how to get vulnerable, and how to do the work. Now, I know people say, oh, God, you know, you go to a program and you have to work. Well, yeah, I'm sorry. If you want to get well, you actually do have to work for it. You've got to take a lot of action and you've got to do things that are the most uncomfortable things in your world. But the benefit from that and the outcome is that you get to live a life that isn't ruled by your fears and isn't ruled by, feeling judged. And so that's what AA taught me initially was how to get connected, how to belong, and how to get honest. Then I started with the steps because I chose a sponsor whose experience was doing the steps, and her experience showed me to go through the steps. So I went through the steps of recovery and did the best I could with where I was at in life. And so AA taught me then how to face the hard stuff in my life. So that husband that had bankrupted me, I had tried and tried and tried to work our marriage out because I was embarrassed that I was on my fourth and couldn't make them work. So I thought I'm going to hang around no matter what. You know, this program allowed me to step away from that relationship gracefully because I started to believe in myself again. It also helped me to repair my relationships with my adult children. And, you know, even to this day, I can actually own my behaviours to my adult children. Now, that's coming in waves. And what the fellowship teaches me is that I can actually overcome any emotion if I put the principles of AA into it. Mm. So if I'm feeling overwhelmed, vulnerable, like I want to run away and I'm full of fear, it's taught me to bring a higher power into my world. So for me, AA has allowed me to hand over my will and my life to a higher power who some days I call God, some days I call the universe, some days I call you bloody bastard, whatever. That's my higher power, and that's somebody, a power greater than myself that I don't actually have to be my own God. I don't have to make my own decisions, and I don't have to worry every day about how I'm going to get through the day because I can hand over in the morning, which allows me then to live a life of freedom just for that day because that's the work of that day. So what did that also teach me? To get around a whole lot of different meetings. You know, I've got a beautiful fellowship today where I have incredible friends. Like the people in the fellowship know more about me than my own family, and I trust them with my life. And I've got pockets of friends all over Melbourne, some in Sydney. You know, I do a Bali convention every year in which I catch up with people. The people in AA are probably the backbone of my life and the program itself. Mm. So I feel, you know, like I'm one of these people that, you know, like preaches all how amazing it is. It doesn't mean to say that my life is perfect. I've had to go through some really tough stuff later in life because life happens, right? A beautiful sponsor I have has had to go through some tough times too, and so, you know, sometimes we role model back and forth how to do life together, and those beautiful women that loved me back to life, most of them are still in my life. We did lose one of them who went back out and drank again, and that she was my little sober sister. We had the same sponsor, and she was 6 months ahead of me, and She got a resentment in AA and decided to go back out and drink. Mm. Devastating stuff. One of the other girls decided she would go out to drink, and she's come back in.
Mm.
So it's been brilliant, and I've loved it.
Awesome. Thank you. That's probably all the time we've got today. I love listening to you. Thank you. If you'd like to find out more about Alcoholics Anonymous, then you can phone them on 1-300-222-222, or you can go online at aa.org.au. I'd like to thank Lisa for coming into the 3CR studios and sharing her experience of Alcoholics Anonymous and her recovery experience with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
No, you're welcome. It's just wonderful. I hope that you'll be able to join us again next week when Anne will have a guest talking about their recovery in the Al-Anon family groups.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.